You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was a pivotal, if overlooked, figure in the civil rights movement. Hamer was a sharecropper, lived in Mississippi, and became an activist in her mid-40s for voting rights and Black political engagement. She is the subject of a new book examining her life and legacy. Keisha N. Blaine is Associate Professor of History at the University of Pittsburgh, and her new book, it's called Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And she spoke with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson.
Let's look at Fannie Lou Hamer's life. What do we know about her life before she got involved in the civil rights movement?
Fannie Lou Hamer was born and grew up in Mississippi and spent most of her life working as a sharecropper. And so this is very important when you think about her involvement in the civil rights movement, because she came from a very different background than many of the activists that are a lot more well-known. So very different background than someone like Martin Luther King Jr. or John Lewis or even Rosa Parks. And so when we think about her early life before she became involved in the movement, it's important to focus specifically on the challenges she endured living a life of poverty and working as a sharecropper in Mississippi.
And let's really quickly talk about just the legacy of sharecropping, because I think we hear about it as just this is something that people did in the South without really looking at how brutal it could be, how it kept a lot of people in poverty.
Yes, this was a system that developed in the aftermath of slavery. And what's really unfortunate is when it comes to sharecropping, it ultimately allowed for Black people to remain in a system of poverty, certainly. Through sharecropping, one could not actually own property. And it meant that Black people would continue to give of their labor and not actually have much for themselves. So it was a system of exploitation that kept Black people in a never-ending cycle of debt and dependency.
Let's talk about how Fannie Lou Hamer really was turned on to voting, to the civil rights movement, because as you said, she wasn't like John Lewis, who was involved in the early days. It was kind of a chance meeting. Is that correct?
Well, she became involved in the movement much later in life, at the age of 44. And this is significant because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, she spent her life working as a sharecropper and in August of 1962 had an opportunity to attend a mass meeting. And this was a mass meeting that had been organized by activists in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And this was a transformative moment for her. She attended this mass meeting at a local church where she learned not only about the movement, but according to Hamer, that's where she learned about her rights, her voting rights as a citizen of the United States.
And I think that maybe many people listening might take that for granted, that there would be people out there who didn't know that they technically had the right to vote. But can you set the scene a little bit that the South at the time and in many other parts of the country didn't make it easy?
Absolutely. Hamer herself spoke about some of the challenges that she endured leading up to this moment and the context that ultimately made it difficult for her to know a lot of this information. So one of the things that she pointed out was how difficult it was being in a remote community, not necessarily being fully tapped into everything that was taking place, certainly on a national level. So that there's that. But also, she did not have much formal education. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that Hamer ultimately spent much of her early life helping her family. And she obtained about a sixth grade education and did not have full exposure to a lot of the resources and information that many others would have had outside of this particular context of sharecropping. And so it's, in some ways it is surprising, but it also speaks to the lengths that white supremacists would go in this particular period to keep Black people, not only from the vote, but particularly even from access to quality education.
We are talking to Keisha N. Blaine right now. She's an author and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And we're talking about the life and legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, who was an integral part of the civil rights movement, but we don't always get to hear about her or learn about her. So let's continue looking at her involvement. So she goes to one of these mass meetings that was put on by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was in her mid-40s. She was a sharecropper and lived in Mississippi. As she got involved in this, in the civil rights campaign, particularly as it came to voting, you know, what was her involvement like?
Well, one of the things about Fannie Lou Hamer that I think is important to focus on is what I talk about in the book as her radical honesty. She was very vocal, never minced her words, always spoke boldly and passionately about what she cared about. So it's not ironic that it was actually her powerful speech in 1964 at the Democratic National Convention that ultimately catapulted her career. And so, as I mentioned, she was involved starting in 1962, and 2 years later, she gave this remarkable speech that was televised. So many people saw it. So many people were moved by it. And that was just one glimpse of how she contributed to the movement, always speaking truth to power.
And can we actually talk about that speech for a minute? Because it was at the DNC, it was before the Credentials Committee, and for President Lyndon Johnson at the time, she really, really scared him in some ways. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the White House responded when she went to speak at the committee?
Yes, well, it's important first to understand the context in thinking about why she was there in the first place. She played a pivotal role in establishing the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And this was a step that ultimately shed light on the exclusion of Black people in the National Democratic Party. And so she made people uncomfortable from the minute she showed up with other members from the group, because they were there to ultimately demand representation, to demand that Black people have a say, have a voice, and representation. And it's not surprising that when she started speaking, it was clear that she was making a powerful impact. People were moved by her words. She spoke about racial violence. She spoke about state-sanctioned violence. She spoke about voter suppression, many of the challenges that she endured personally, but also the challenges that, other Black people were facing in Mississippi in particular, and across the South. And President Lyndon B. Johnson did not actually want to hear that. So he tried to block her speech. He interrupted, in fact, simply because I think it was clear to him, as it certainly was to so many others, that this was a speech that could change everything. This was a moment where people were not only being moved, but ultimately moved to act, that he knew that it would galvanize people to demand changes and radical changes quickly. And so that terrified him, as it terrified so many others.
That's historian Keisha N. Blaine talking with WPR's J. Carlisle Larson. Blaine's new book is called Until I Am Free and explores the life of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer. We'll pick up this conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation between historian Keisha N. Blaine and WPR's J. Carlisle Larson. They spoke about the life and legacy of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer.
So let's talk to a little bit about what her experience was like. She, and I'm hitting this a lot because it's really important that she really stood at the intersection of a lot of things. She could speak to her experience living in poverty. She could speak to her experience as being a woman. She could importantly speak to her experience as being a Black woman. How did that ultimately resonate with people throughout the movement over the years?
I think it left a lasting impact. One of the things that was so powerful about Hamer is that she just knew how to connect with people. People could relate to her. She just had this warm personality. And so there's so many different narratives that I encountered in the process of writing the book, of people talking about how they would visit her home, how she would welcome them in, how she would give them a plate of food, how she would sit with them and talk to them and listen to them. And I think part of that was made possible because of her unique experiences. She could relate to so many different people because of what she endured as a working poor Black woman, as a disabled activist in the South, as someone with limited formal education, right? There were so many aspects of her life that made her quite different than many of the other visible leaders in the movement. And that made a difference. People connected with her and they trusted her.
And if we could talk just for a minute too, she was disabled, and correct me if I'm wrong, she became disabled in part because of violence that she experienced as being part of the civil rights movement. Is that correct?
It is. She spoke about ultimately in her early life, one of the things that she talks about is contracting polio. So that's the first thing that's important to emphasize. But it is, in fact, a brutal beating that she endured in Winona, Mississippi in 1963 that exacerbated a limp and ultimately left her with a number of ailments, physical ailments that she carried for the rest of her life. And that certainly, I think, was important for her because she spoke about her experiences. She spoke about the brutal beating. I mentioned earlier about, you know, how she really honed in on this idea of radical honesty. And that is true when it came to her painful experience of violence on multiple occasions.
One thing that has stood out to me in learning more about Fannie Lou Hamer was, you know, she was an activist. She advocated for voting rights. She advocated for better representation of Black Americans. And she also ran for office. Can you talk a little bit about why she ran for office and the impact it had?
Yes, this is so important because Fannie Lou Hamer, I think, just spent her life trying to devise strategies to improve lives, to improve the lives of everyone around her. Certainly committed to advancing Black political rights, but more broadly, she was committed to advancing the cause of human rights. One of the things that she emphasized was the importance of public service. And she tried. She ran for office 3 times total, was unsuccessful. But one of the things that she admitted was that even when she knew it was unlikely that she could win, it was still powerful. It was still meaningful for her to do it because she wanted to send a message to other people that Black people certainly could serve in office, could hold positions that would give them the ability to introduce policies and lead initiatives that could address social injustice. And so she tried throughout her lifetime to not only talk about the importance of Black political participation, but show through her example by running for office, even though she was unsuccessful.
So, Dr. Blaine, one thing that I would like to touch on is just the role of, you know, Black women in particular in social justice movements. We have Fannie Lou Hamer as being this important figure in the civil rights movement, but today we don't always hear about her. We hear a lot about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Can you talk about Black women being centered in a lot of these movements?
Well, I think to this very day, mainstream narratives on the civil rights movement tend to be male-dominated narratives. And this is not to say that historians have not been writing about the significant role that women have played in the movement. We certainly have lots of great books. on this topic, but there is still, there is still this resistance, I think, on the mainstream level when we talk about the movement. There's this resistance to center women in particular, and it's somewhat, I think, shocking to me, because if you look at, for example, the Montgomery bus boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 is a moment in history that catapulted the career of Martin Luther King Jr. And we know him because that's the moment where he became involved in the Montgomery Improvement Association. That's when he became well known on a national level. Of course, the actual boycott was started by Black women, a group of women in the Women's Political Council, individuals like Joanne Robinson. So I give that as an example to say that even when we identify Black men who are important leaders, clearly, in the struggle for civil rights, their experiences are not divorced from the significant contributions of Black women in the movement. It's impossible to talk about the civil rights movement without thinking about someone like Fannie Lou Hamer, without thinking about the work of, Ella Baker and, Septima Clark, and just so many others who, even if they were hidden from public view, not by choice, but oftentimes because they were pushed aside or marginalized in the movement, they were vital to shaping the movement as organizers and as leaders behind the scenes.
We are talking to Keisha N. Blaine right now, author and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her latest book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And we are talking about the history of Fannie Lou Hamer and her role in the civil rights movement. And can you talk a little bit about how Fannie Lou Hamer first showed up for you as part of your education?
I first learned about Fannie Lou Hamer as a college student. And at the time, I had already declared a major in history. I was also pursuing a second major in Africana studies. And so I was primarily taking courses on the experiences of Black people in the US as well as globally. And in 2008, I was taking a course on the American Civil Rights Movement. And that's the first time that I learned about Hamer. I was surprised that it took me that long to find out about her because I just found her story so remarkable, so moving, so inspirational. And I could really relate to her. I could connect to her, you know, as someone coming from, you know, a working class background, as someone really trying to find my way at the time as a college student in a predominantly white institution. And finding Hamer, I think, was a moment that changed me, but it was surprising that it took so long to find out about her.
I want to talk about the title of your book for a second, because it's Until I Am Free, but the rest of what Fannie Lou Hamer said is, until I am free, you are not free either. Can you talk about how important that phrase was?
That phrase is so important, and it's exactly why I wanted to name the book Until I Am Free, because I felt like it was important for people to understand how much we are all connected. And this is part of Hamer's vision, her political vision of human rights, a vision that ultimately saw every single human as connected to the next. She wanted people to understand that if you are truly a part of the American polity, you cannot live your life without paying attention to what's taking place around you. You cannot live your life without paying attention to what is happening to other people in the United States. And I think this is a message that is so powerful. Of course, we know that not everyone embraces this message, but I think there is power in the message in knowing that our futures are connected. We may have different backgrounds. We have different experiences. Clearly, we have so many differences as people, but we are united through humanity. And when we fight for our freedom, we have to also be fighting for the freedom of others. So I think that that phrase encapsulates the power of unity, of solidarity. And certainly this is a message that we all need.
As a historian, Dr. Blaine, we've been talking about Fannie Lou Hamer's legacy in her life, but there's still a lot of history to learn. What do you want people to take away from this book?
I want people to leave this book with a clear sense of the power of the individual, to understand that one can make a difference in society, even with few material resources, even with limited access, even with limited formal education. I think we often focus on the things we don't have, but I hope that people read the book and think about ways they can contribute, think about ways they can make a difference using whatever skills and talents and abilities they have, and that we shift from excuses to solutions.
They called it Spotted Cow, and the rest, they say, is history. We're checking in on New Glarus Brewing Company in these pandemic times on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Spotted Cow helped propel New Glarus Brewing to be what it is today, the 12th largest craft brewer by sales volume in the nation. That's from the trade group The Brewers Association publishing its top 50 craft brewing rankings earlier this year. Has your favorite brewery reopened? What questions do you have about brewing in these times? 800-642-1234. Deb Carey is founder and president of New Glarus Brewing Company, based in New Glarus, a village in Greene County in the southern part of our state. Deb, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, tell us about your company's pandemic journey, if you will. What is the story in these times?
Well, I mean, we got through it successfully, so it has a happy ending. But of course, when it started, it was really scary. There's 120 people with their families that depend on, you know, us being open and paychecks and healthcare and all those things. And you remember that initially we didn't have really clear information on how the virus was being transmitted and what to do. And basically we just erred on the side of safety and sent everybody home for a couple of months while, you know, the politicians and health professionals figured it out.
Yeah. And so you made that deliberate decision to keep those 120 employees on your payroll in the pandemic. What went into that decision not to apply for the federal PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program?
Well, the PPP and the decision to care for the people are a little bit separated, because the decision to care for my people just comes from my deep-seated respect and care for our people. I mean, we're a team. It takes a lot of people to make great beer, and they are just outstanding human beings that we really care about them, and we see them in the grocery stores, and, you know, I want to visit with their children and have them come play with us. And, you know, you can't do that if you don't take care of people. The PPP was more just an overarching understanding that even though the numbers sounded big, you know, oh, there's all this money to apply for, I knew that we would be okay, and that I have lots of neighbors in New Glarus and other breweries that really desperately needed the money and were on the verge of going under. And, you know, like you said, we're doing well with our Spotted Cow sales. And so I just chose to pass on it.
Hmm. You reopened the brewery recently for in-person tours on weekdays. How is that going so far?
Well, it's a little overwhelming. We have in the past, people come on the weekends, and of course we just get slammed. Thousands of people show up. But during the week has been pretty quiet. Last week, we didn't really announce it. We just, you know, opened, and there were lots of happy people there and relaxed. And I think it feels nice for people to be able to get back to a little bit of normalcy, and we're really happy to be open and see them.
Yeah, and why not be open on the weekends? What goes into that decision?
Well, during the summer, I hire seasonal help, and it's like 20 or 25 people, maybe more, that I need between parking and all the places to serve beer and help people. And, you know, we're at the very end of the season, so it really doesn't make sense to bring people on for Saturday work for just a few weeks. And, you know, when it gets back to next spring, we'll have an opportunity to hire again and do some training and get back to being open at least on Saturdays. But I think our one thing about our COVID experience is we really appreciate our family time. And I don't think we'll open again on Sundays. Everybody needs a day of rest. And so our plan will be to open on Saturdays sometime in the spring.
Kind of like an aha moment in the pandemic, coming to that realization, I imagine.
Yeah, I think I've been aware of it for a long time, but I don't know. It just feels right. And we're really primarily a brewery. I mean, we're not a hospital. We're not selling gas or groceries or something that people can't live without. And, you know, this feels right for our team. And this is a direction we're going to go.
Deb Carey is president and owner of New Glarus Brewing Company with us as we explore the brewing company's story in these pandemic times. Are you a brewer? What do you want to ask the makers of Spotted Cow? Join in at 800-642-1234. Steve is joining us from Stoughton with a question. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Good morning. Say, Deb, great to hear you on the show. You know, Spotted Cow is so synonymous with Wisconsin. And there's, you know, seems like there's always this big push from others to have you move across the different borders and, that, you know, expand nationwide. What is your thought about that?
Oh, good question. Thanks, Steve. Well, really, my primary responsibility as an employer is not to be the biggest. My primary responsibility is to be the best and to be profitable. And in my mind, the whole idea of bigger is better is really flawed. And during the pandemic, we had a good opportunity to prove that, because one of the things that we can do with a small footprint was recall all of our beer and, you know, give a credit back to our wholesalers and to the retailers, which was helpful to them in a time of crisis. And if we had been in 6 or 8 states, we wouldn't have been able to do that. So being close to home allows us to have personal relationships and better control over the quality of the beer, which at the end of the day is, you know, really what we're focused on. So I know there are a ton of people that would like us to be nationwide, and I get asked all the time to, you know, won't I sell beer in China or France or something else, which, you know, just doesn't make sense to me. Beer is the same ingredients as bread. And just like bread, it's best fresh. And anybody who's brought back a baguette from France knows that it doesn't taste quite as good as it did in Paris. But it is fun, you know. So for me, we're going to stick with our Fresh is Best program here in Wisconsin.
Well, Steve, while we have you on the line, you know, what beer do you love?
Spotted Cow is probably my favorite, but it depends on who you ask in my family. That's one of the big raging debates over the holidays, right? So I'm thrilled that she's going to stay right here. I think New Glarus is a Wisconsin gem, and I hope she keeps doing everything she's doing because she's doing it right.
Well, here's the deal. Like, you have like an instant holiday gift for those loved ones who are out of state, I would imagine.
Well, you know, it's probably a double gift, because I give them that gift, and then on the way out back to Chicago or Iowa or Minnesota, they stop at a Quick Trip or a gas station and pick up another case. So it's probably another gift and a half, maybe, but I totally agree.
Deb, how do you feel about this math in the gift giving?
Well, I'm pretty appreciative of his support. And I think it is true. We had one of the things that was really another interesting thing from COVID was we could measure what sales were at the borders of our states, because people, you know, for a while they weren't allowed to travel from Illinois. And it looks like it's about half of 1% of our overall sales. So it is important to us. And we're just, you know, as an employee-owned business, we are just really grateful for that support.
Yeah, Steve, thanks for calling in. You know, Deb, brewing and distributing beer, as we're learning, can take months of planning and work. And that really is so difficult in a pandemic where you're basically day to day. How difficult have logistics of brewing been in these times?
It has. I mean, it's getting better, but it was a total nightmare. I mean, things changed wildly day to day. You can remember times when it was like one county was open for business and another one was closed. Well, when Milwaukee shuts down or Madison or Green Bay, that's a lot of beer sales. Mm-hmm. And it was, we had shortages of cans and bottles. The label manufacturers, of course, their people were home. So it was really, we took a lot of brain space and a team of people, and we were just in there every day. Even though we'd sent everybody else home, we were in there every day trying to figure out where to move beer and how to do it. And I'm just really glad we got through it. We did a bunch of things that might be a little counterintuitive, but we got rid of a lot of our seasonal beers, which we're happy to be able to bring back now, and our specialty beers so that we could keep people home and the team separated during the pandemic. And I mean, I'm just will forever be proud that we got through it all together with everybody healthy and safe.
Mm. Are you feeling any of those supply chain pressures now with bottles, as we've been seeing in the headlines?
Yeah, it still is happening. I mean, bottles in particular, it is such an old world art, you know, melting down sand to make a container. And the people who do that in Burlington, Wisconsin, they've got a factory that's, while it's old, it has gotten a lot of updates. And we're glad for that. But I mean, they work in really loud, hot conditions, and little changes in temperature can make a big difference. And if part of the personnel are home or they're trying to keep space, it has a real impact on their production. Mm. And same with cans. Not only that, consumers overall have moved toward more celebrations at home. And so there just is a call for a lot more cans and bottles from all industries, not just breweries. And so all those things are creating a shortage, but we're working through it.
Some craft brewers figured out how to make it work in the pandemic era. We're talking with one of them. Deb Carey is here, founder of New Glarus Brewing Company. You can join in. Do you work for a bar or restaurant that was shut down early? Are you a brewer who has had trouble getting supplies? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Deb Carey here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The beer industry has seen a dramatic decline both in jobs and sales due to the pandemic. That's according to the Trade Association for the American Brewing Industry, the Beer Institute. Wisconsin lost more than 15,000 jobs last year tied to the industry, and the Institute calculated a nearly $20 billion drop nationwide in retail beer sales last year. Still time to talk about the industry, 800-642-1234. Deb Carey is president of New Glarus Brewing Company and with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to Kevin now in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hey, good morning. I'm not a fan of the Spotted Cow, but I love the Fat Squirrel and the Belgian Red in particular. Thank you for putting that in the smaller bottles. Any thoughts into moving in toward the darker beers, the porters or the stouts? Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. Deb?
Well, I'm sorry Kevin missed out on Gyrator, which was just out, because that was a big double. And at the brewery just now, there is an Imperial Stout and also a Bourbon Barrel Stout available. So we do play in the area of dark beers pretty regularly. I'm trying to think. We've been doing flipping between Coffee Stout and Road Slush, which is an oatmeal stout, in the winter, and I don't know exactly when that's coming out, but we do make them. And I'm sorry we haven't found them for you, but if you send us a message on our Facebook, we'll hook you up with some dark beers. And I'm really glad you like Fat Squirrel, because that's one of my favorites too.
So let me get this straight. You had a pandemic baby, and the gyrator Doppel is your pandemic baby?
Maybe. Finally got a fish on the label.
So explain a little bit the backstory here of the gyrator.
Well, one thing about the gyrator is it has an incredibly long lager. So it worked out actually just like you're saying to be our pandemic baby. And Dan has a long list of beers in his head that he is dying to make. And I have to say that he, you know, his priority also is to take care of our people. But he was a little mumbly about getting all of his fun beers cut from the lineup last year. And he is in a much better mood today.
But this really, this matured for, is it 6 months? 6 months for flavor?
Yeah.
So this was quite a while.
Yes, it was. But it worth it. I mean, it's a great beer, super smooth. That the thing that's really interesting about beer when you're involved in it is it's extremely fussy. It's prone to just a tiny temperature difference or this, the thing that you're referring to of long lagers and natural carbonation and all the, you know, where the raw materials come from. They can have a huge impact on the flavor. Beer is just really delicate and fussy. And, that's why not that many people actually do it and put it into cans themselves, because it's hard, but it's worth it. We have a dedicated team and they love what they do and we love them for it.
And you found a German hop that was basically kind of undercover, if you will, not commercially available today.
Yes, this is raw materials are Dan's passion, because that's what he needs to make beer. So he has been on the hunt for old world barleys and hops and things that maybe they weren't high yield, you know, enough to capture the attention of farmers, but they have a wonderful flavor. And he, pushes to hunt them down and get farmers to grow them and then uses them in beer. And he's been dedicating himself to this effort for probably 20 years. And it's a great thing for us.
Talking with Deb Carey, owner president of New Glarus Brewing Company. You can join in the conversation 800-642-1234. David is joining us from Green Bay. David, hi. You have seasonal beers on your mind, I understand.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Deb, I really appreciate you being on the air. I love the story. My two favorite beers in the world are Bubbler and Dancing Man. They're two of your Hefes, and they don't come out at the same time of year. There was 1 month I remember where I could get both of them, and that was one of the best months of my life. I might have stocked up more than I otherwise do or otherwise think is prudent. I just want to know a little bit about how the decision to release one beer at one time of the year and another at a different time works out. Like, what about, it doesn't have to be these two specifically, like Bubbler and Dancing Man, but when something doesn't jump out as being like an Oktoberfest beer, because of course that's going to come out at a certain time. What goes into deciding when a seasonal beer comes out, and other things like, sorry, I'm excited and I don't want to ask too much of you.
No, that's okay.
What's the timeline from like coming up with an idea like Dancing Man and then getting it to the shelf? Is that, I mean, you just said Gyrator takes like 6 months. Is it, I'd just love to hear the timeline and thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Yeah, good questions. So from concept to beer on the shelf is well over a year. It might even be 2 or 5 years. Often Dan's doing things like, he was making Berliner Weiss with wine yeast and special grapes. And so to find it, make a little batch, see how it works, and to actually get it onto the schedule to produce, and then the time of actually making it, the lagering and all of that, there's way more time in it than people realize. So thanks for asking the question. As for how we put together the calendar, first we ask everyone in, I think it's July, we have a beer vote on our website and we ask people what they're looking for and what their ideas are. Then we compile them and look at, you know, the top winners and try to figure out a way to fit it into the calendar. And one of my goals with retail on-premise in mind is to have beers that are appropriate for what the food I think might be being served that time of the year, certainly heavier beers in the winter and lighter beers, like this caller was referring to, wheat beers and hefes in the summer and spring when it warms up. And then we try hard not to have the same kind of beer out at the same time, so that there is a selection. Like I always think of our beer calendar like the menu at a restaurant. We need to have some things there, steak and burgers that people expect to find, but then we'd like to have something interesting if somebody's feeling a little more adventurous. So that's the thing. So we get a vote, then there's a group of us and everybody comes with their ideas and their passion, and we try to see where we can fit it into the production schedule, because also some beers are just really more labor intensive and time intensive to make. And, you know, if at the same time that we're trying to come out with a volume of beer, like say August or September, all those things come into play.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you do quite a bit of crowdsourcing and listening to yeah. your consumers to really give you some direction as to what you should make.
Yeah, you know, it's the funniest thing that you bring that up, Kate, because sometimes people will corner me and they're like, why don't you sell more IPAs or, you know, whatever their thing is. And I think to myself, oh, do you think I'm in charge? Like, do you think I walk up to Phil Woodman and I'm like, hey, Phil, give me some space. Like, that's not really how it works. consumers really vote. Consumers are the ones who vote. And every single beer that we put out on the shelf comes from the heart. And Dan puts an inordinate amount of time and energy and years of passion and blood, sweat, and tears into every single beer that we make. And we hope all of them will be wildly successful, and we know that they won't. And so we just put them out there and see what resonates. And sometimes things that, you know, like a beer style that didn't sell one year, we'll bring it back in a few years. And all of a sudden it takes off and don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just kind of very tenacious. That's what we are.
Deb, thank you for joining us.
Yes. Thank you for having me, Kate. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Deb and Dan Carey, owners of New Glarus Brewing Company based in New Glarus, Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.